Welcome to the Edge Conservation Podcast, where we bring you the latest in innovation, insight, and effort on the front lines of wildlife conservation in Africa and around the world. I'm your host, Kira Dorian. Today, we are taking you to Mumbai, India, to speak with Kedar Gore, who's the director of the Corbett Foundation, who works to mitigate the human-wildlife conflict in India. Kedar, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Kira. I'm so glad that I'm here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So could you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to work in conservation?
I was passionate about wildlife since my childhood. I belong to a place, a region called Konkan, which is along the west coast of Maharashtra in India. And that's a biodiversity hotspot, actually, which is very connected to the Western Ghats. I used to spend a lot of time there as a child, and that really, inspired me to appreciate nature, observe birds, animals and plants and a lot of other things. And as I grew up, I realized and I started going out on nature walks, on birding trips, on treks to various forests throughout the country. And this really inspired me to work for nature always. Because as I visited all these places, apart from the beauty that I saw there, I also saw a lot of things that should not be happening in a forest. So this is what really drove me to work for conservation. So I took up the decision to study biology as my major subject in graduation, post-graduation. Right now I'm also pursuing my PhD in wildlife sciences. And I started working as soon as I passed out from my university. I started working with WWF India. Thereafter, I also worked with the Energy and Resources Institute, and currently I work with the Corbett Foundation. Now, that's almost 10 years that I've spent with this wonderful organization.
Oh, fantastic. So tell us about the organization. I mean, I know that your focus is working on the human-wildlife conflict, but what does that look like? What kind of work are you guys doing?
Well, the Corbett Foundation was established in 1994. That's almost 25 years from before now. It was established by Mr. Dilip Khatau, who is the founder chairman. The whole purpose of establishing this organization was to mitigate human-wildlife conflict. Now, India is one of the biodiversity hotspots. We have extraordinary wildlife, right from tigers to great Indian bustards to whale sharks and whatnot. So all these protected areas and forests and ecosystems, they are actually interspersed with human population. They are heavily human-dominated landscapes. And when human and wildlife, they sort of exist together in an ecosystem, there are bound to be human-wildlife conflict. So there were a lot of issues where, people in India, mostly they live in villages. They have a lot of livestock. The livestock are sent to the forest for grazing. And when the livestock are grazing, they become easy prey for tigers. So human beings see tigers as their enemies because they are killing their livestock, which is probably the only source of income for their villager there. So we initiated a program way back in 1996 where we started paying interim cash compensation to the people who lost their livestock to tigers. And this helped tremendously in, pacifying the angry villagers and whatever retaliatory feelings that might come into their minds, we could sort of, pacify them by paying this interim relief. So this program worked well, and we could see the results that people, antagonism of the people towards tigers and leopards and other wild animals was slowly coming down. So this was one of the first projects that we started in around Corbett Tiger Reserve in North India, with the collaboration with WWF India. And then we started working in other areas in Western India, in Gujarat. We started working in Central India, in Kanha and Bandhavgarh Tiger Reserves. We also established our work in East India, in Kaziranga Tiger Reserve, where great Indian Vanadium rhinoceros is one of the flagship species. So the primary objective has always been mitigating human-wildlife conflicts. We believe that people will always be in forests or any natural ecosystem. So instead of driving them out, which is not possible, and we ethically don't think it is correct, so we work with them to provide them solutions which can make their life less dependent on forests. So it may be provided with livelihood initiatives, or it may be providing them with immediate medical services, primary health care, veterinary services, or any kind of rural development work that will ensure that they don't have to venture into the forest always. We provide them with energy efficient stoves so that their dependency on firewood, which is again derived from the forest, goes down. Solar energy is something that we promote a lot. We provide them with solar lights so that their life becomes better, because most of these forest areas, electricity hasn't reached. So, they live in darkness after evening hours. The life can be very tough. I mean, you can imagine what it can be. So wherever we see any opportunity that we can work with them, make their life better and less dependent on forest, we work on that issue.
That's wonderful. And I know that you have an educational component as well. And I have to tell you, it's been amazing recording this podcast, because pretty much everyone we have talked to has said educating the next generation is the key to conservational change. And so I know that you have an educational component. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Corbett Foundation does with regards to educating the next generation, and why you personally feel that it's so important?
It's absolutely, absolutely essential. And I'm glad you asked this question. This is something very close to my heart as well. Because when I started my career almost 25 years ago, that was with WWF, which is a very, very well-known organization, as you might know. Mm-hmm. And I was working as education officer. I used to be in charge of education programs in schools and colleges among local people living in Mumbai and, around Mumbai. So that is something that I loved a lot. And educating people, making people aware about the natural resources and the beauty of biodiversity is something that has always been my passion. So I continue doing that as a part of the Corbett Foundation. Corbett Foundation is actually an organization with about 100 people working there in across all the offices that we have. And we have a fantastic team. We have wildlife biologists, we have environmentalists, we have social workers, we have doctors, we have veterinarians, we have management professionals. So it's actually a combination of a lot of disciplines come together. So environment education has been a very, very important component of our programs. We work with around 400 villages, in 400 villages, and there are quite a few schools and colleges in these areas, where we interact with the students on a regular basis. We initiate something called as a nature club, so that students are regularly in touch with us. We expose them to the fascinating nature around them. We take them out on nature walks. We conduct indoor sessions, slide presentations for them. We conduct competitions for them. We also create a lot of resource material, posters and booklets that will help them in understanding the subject better. Now, this is purely environment education program that we do, but education is absolutely essential and important, and it becomes an integral part of all our programs. Even if we are running our medical program, we also have health education program, because we believe that prevention is better than cure. You know, we always provide medical help in treating a particular patient for a particular ailment, but preventing that particular ailment is something that is our focus. So we have an education component for our medical program also. We have educational component for our veterinary program also, where we regularly are in touch with the community members in making them understand how they have to maintain their domestic livestock, because this domestic livestock is regularly going to the forest areas. If they are not treated or if they are not vaccinated, there is always a risk of disease transmission from domestic livestock to the wild herbivores in the forest. So this is a very, very important interface, and that's why we have a lot of focus on education in all our programs.
That's fantastic. And so tell me more about the medical program, because I read about this when I was doing some research on the Corbett Foundation. I loved the philosophy, which sounded like a cross between providing it because it's the right thing to do, but also this idea that a healthy body is more able to care about the environment and the animals and conservation efforts. And I just thought that was such an interesting perspective. So tell me more about that.
This program also was one of the oldest programs that we started. That was way back in 1997. What happens is, in forest areas, medical, primary health care and medical services are very rarely near the villages. Sometimes a village may be about 50 kilometers away from the nearest primary health care center. Now, in that case, it is impossible for that villager to frequently visit the healthcare center for his needs. We believe that if we want people to support in conservation, we must provide them with the basic necessities of life. I mean, medical help is something that everyone in this world needs. So why deprive a particular person living in some remote forest area? With this philosophy, we started providing them with primary health care services at their doorstep. We have doctors on our payroll. We have a mobile medical van, a unit. So doctors visit particular villages every week. For example, one mobile medical unit will be visiting around 35 to 40 villages in a week. So in a day, probably about six to seven villages. And this periodicity is maintained. If I visit village A in 1 week, on Monday in first week, the same village A is visited in the second week on Monday. So the people in that village A know that our doctors will be coming on this particular day around this time, and they are ready if they have any medical issues. They discuss with the doctor, get treated, get medicines and everything. So, and this creates a lot of goodwill. For years, we have been providing this service to a lot of forest-dependent communities. Most of them are also tribals. And we have seen fantastic results, because not only that they get treated and benefited by our medical services, but there is always that feeling of mutual appreciation and respect that they have for us. At the same time, people are always ready to help us out whenever we need them in case of, say, forest fires that are there that may erupt in some of the areas. Sometimes we also get very important information about some suspicious movement around the villages. So these are very crucial things that we have always seen people willingly coming forward and helping us out with. So we see this as a direct support in conservation. If we provide support to villagers, they will come forward and help in conservation. This is what we believe in.
I think that's incredible. I love that perspective. It makes so much sense because it's truly looking at the people in these villages as people, right? They have needs, and it's not just about solving the conflict. It's about making sure that both sides are truly being cared for, and it sounds like that's what you're doing. That's amazing.
Thank you.
So I read this handbook that you co-authored, which was all about preventative measures regarding the human sloth bear conflict in India, so specific to this particular animal. What struck me in this handbook that was so thoughtful and so simple was so much of it was actually about understanding the sloth bear's patterns and timing and choosing then for the people that still do have to go into the forest where those livelihood measures maybe can't solve that issue, helping them understand the timing and the patterns so that when they do go into the forest, they're less likely to come across a sloth bear and less likely to have that conflict happen. And I thought that was just very clever. So I'm curious, are there other key ideas that you have that are like that, just sort of simple or key thoughts to solving this conflict that if people knew about them, they could just make these slight alterations and really make a difference?
Yes, of course. See, when we created this handbook, pictorial handbook on mitigating sloth bear attacks, we first did a lot of research. We studied that area because this was actually, the area that we studied is Kanha-Penj corridor, which is a very beautiful forest connecting two important tiger reserves in India, Kanha Tiger Reserve and Penj Tiger Reserve. We visited several households where previous sloth bear attacks had taken place, and we took a lot of interviews of the forest department officers and the field staff. Ourselves did a lot of transects. We tried to find out which are the hotspots where sloth bears exist, and you know, hotspots of conflict as well. When we had this idea, we thought our research should not remain in some report lying in some library. It should be made available to the local people because it is ultimately they who are suffering. If any kind of research, if it doesn't help in grassroots conservation, personally, I feel that research is useless. So we thought we will create a handbook, which will be pictorial, because if we create something complicated, people are not going to read. So language is always a barrier. So we wanted something pictorial, even if people flip through that handbook. And of course, eventually we have also created a poster in local language. By looking at this poster or the depictions or illustrations on this poster and the handbook, people immediately know what they are supposed to be doing and what they are not supposed to do. Whether they come across when they come across a sloth bear, what would be their reaction? What should they be doing? What are the timings? Because many times sloth bears are nocturnal animals. They also have to eat certain fruits which people also like. So what generally used to happen in these areas, that people would go into the forest early in the morning and then try to fetch, you know, the fruits that even the sloth bears liked. So there was always a conflict. So we are working with the people and trying to make them understand that if you just let the sloth bear finish its eating and even then you go and visit the forest, it would be possible that, you know, you don't come across a sloth bear and automatically the conflict is prevented. So there are many other things. It's not only about sloth bear. Many times people are also having huge conflicts with leopards, because leopards are more adaptable large cats, and because they are adaptable, they can live in multiple habitats, not only in forest, but, you know, at the outskirts of forest, among bushes, among agricultural fields. So they immediately come into contact with human beings. And leopards also prey on smaller animals. So, you know, the goats that the people might be rearing, or sometimes accidentally they prey upon even kids or human beings. In India, open defecation is an issue because not all villages have toilets. So people when they go to attend nature's calls. I mean, this is the time when leopard attacks mostly happen. So there are a lot of things that we have to work with the villagers, that we have to make them understand that wild animals don't mean them harm purposefully. It is their actions which need to be modified so that you can avoid confrontation with your wild animals. So again, snake bites is an issue in most of the rural India. We have also created poster on common venomous snakes in that area, the snakes which are non-venomous, so that people know when they see a snake, whether it is a venomous snake or a non-venomous snake, they can always avoid both kinds of snakes. If unfortunately there is a snake bite, what they should be doing, where they should be approaching, what are the immediate steps, you know, any kind of first aid that they can apply to the person who has been bitten by a snake. So we try to create as much as material which will help in, again, I'm coming back to the same thing, mitigating human wildlife conflict. So if we have less confrontation between human beings and wild animals, it is always better. Both need their own space and their own respect. Yeah.
And it, again, it, like the theme that I'm hearing, which I think is just so special, is that it's for you, for the Corbett Foundation, what you're doing is, again, caring for both sides, acknowledging, you know, the patterns of these animals and how understanding that can be helpful to the humans, but also understanding that the humans do need to go in, and this is how to slightly change their actions in order to still meet their needs and meet the needs of the animal. I just think that's beautiful. So you have also focused a lot of your work on the preservation of the bustard, which is a bird, I have to be honest with you, I had never heard of. So tell me about this bird. Tell me why this bird has drawn your attention, and tell me about some of the work that you've done with regard to the bustard.
Bustards are actually old world species. They are found mostly in Asia and some parts of Europe. The bustard that we are working on is the Great Indian Bustard. It's one of the largest flying birds of India and heaviest flying birds of India. The adult male can weigh up to about 15 kilograms. Now, it is primarily a bird of a grassland habitat and semi-arid areas. It does not live in forests. Now, most of these, you know, semi-arid areas or grasslands in India are categorized as revenue wastelands. Unfortunately, there's a word wasteland associated with it. However, there is nothing wasteland about it. It's a very important ecosystem. But since it is categorized as revenue wasteland, most of these so-called wastelands are the first areas that are given away for any kind of developmental projects. Unintentional, this diversion of these wastelands for any kind of developmental projects is unintentional, but this unintentional action has really affected the bustard populations drastically. At one point of time, there were thousands of bustards in India, but today the population has dwindled precariously to almost about 150 birds only. And now, and this is the only global population.
Wow.
Because Great Indian Bustard is endemic to Indian subcontinent. It is only found in India and some regions of Pakistan. So if this bird, if you know, enough steps are not taken to protect the habitat of this bird, it is bound to go extinct. So that's why we started focusing on this species, because also because we are working in the Western India, in Gujarat, which is actually a very important habitat of this bird. The current issue that this bird and a lot of other bustard species throughout the world are facing is their collision with overhead power lines. Everywhere people are promoting wind energy and solar energy, which is excellent because that's the best form of energy, which is an alternative to coal-based energy. But because of this wind energy and solar energy projects, which are actually always you know, erected in open areas, and which unfortunately happen to be wastelands as per the government records, but excellent habitats for bustards and a lot of other grassland species. So a lot of power line infrastructure is erected. And the bustard as a bird has a very narrow frontal vision. So there have been a lot of deaths of these bustards, documented deaths of these bustards in the past few years. And mind you, apart from these documented deaths, there may be many other bustards who have already died without even us knowing about them. So the numbers have dwindled like anything. And currently, we are working with the government, with a lot of power companies who are setting up these power plants, with a lot of NGOs, with a lot of local people. Everyone means well. Everyone wants bustards to prevent bustard extinction and them to, you know, flourish and survive in future. So we are looking at options how we can, you know, make things better for these birds, whether we can bury some of the power lines underground and put some bird diverters and reflectors so that probably bustard collision can be prevented. We are trying our best. India has also launched a conservation breeding program of this species. Hopefully, you know, in the next 5 years or so, the situation would be better as far as the bustards are concerned. Now, it is not only Great Indian Bustard. Grasslands also have Lesser Florican, which is another kind of bustard. There are caracals, there are wolves. There are a lot of other animals which only survive in grassland habitat. So generally, you know, there is a perception that when we talk of conservation, it is always about tigers and forests. But these grassland species do not coexist in forests with tigers. So we need to look at individual ecosystems with their own merits. And because they are grasslands, we cannot ignore them. They are very important. Most of the grasslands are also agropastoral landscapes. India is basically a farmer's country. You know, there is a lot of agriculture happening. So if we don't protect these natural grasslands, it's going to be a disaster not only for bustards and other grassland species, but also for human beings. So we are focusing on this bird. This is our program on bustards. We have also published the only coffee table book on the life, capturing the life of Great Indian Bustard. This was released in IUCN World Conservation Congress in 2016.
Amazing. I'm so impressed with the breadth of the work that you are doing. I really am. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you so much.
So tell our listeners what they can do to support your work, especially those of us that are far away. I mean, I am so physically far away from the work that you're doing. So for those listeners that are also far away, how can we support your work?
Well, we are a charity. We are a charitable trust. So and a small NGO with a lot of passion and a lot of vision, but only having vision doesn't help. Vision needs support, financial support. So if we would really appeal to people who appreciate our work to support us financially. Since we are a charity and a registered charity in India, we are authorized to receive foreign contributions and donations. People can support us through our website. There is a very secure payment gateway. They can just go online and, you know, pledge their support through making online payments which directly reach our bank accounts. In addition to that, anywhere, I mean, people can be, apart from providing their monetary support, they can also be influential in several ways. People can, as you have very kindly come forward and, you know, you're interviewing me, this will be online somewhere where people can share this link eventually and know about the work that we do. People can write about us. There are lots of, because even writing about our work abroad somewhere in US or UK or some other country more and more people will get aware of what we are doing. We just want people to know that the Corbett Foundation is one of the NGOs that is doing, you know, grassroots conservation work in India, but there are a lot of other NGOs. We all are taking efforts to make sure that India remains a biodiversity hotspot always. And although whatever challenges our country may face, because we are a developing country, but we would still ensure that wildlife will never be compromised. So we're working with the government, and government also is supporting in many ways. So social media today is very, very active. You know, we are also trying to be on social media. We are on social media and trying to promote our work and our activities through social media, but we have limitations. Most of us are, you know, not technically very, very sound in creating good artwork that can be shared with a lot of people and that can appeal to a lot of people. So people come forward. People have come to us, you know, for their photography assignments. They have come willingly, spend their time. We encourage a lot of volunteers to come and spend time with us. University students are coming and spending time with us to learn about the work that we do, to learn about the research that we are doing, because we also have a very strong ecological research team, which is doing hardcore wildlife research, doing camera trapping and, you know, transect surveys and a lot of other stuff. So we are open for new ideas, and you know, if there could be someone who is technically very sound in making websites, so, you know, someone can make a revamp our website if they think that, you know, our website is not good enough and not good enough to interact with a lot of people or attract a lot of people. So there are lots of ways where people can support, offer support.
So you need a social media manager and you need a website designer. So if any of our listeners are social media managers or website designers.
It would help, really. It would help, yeah.
Fantastic. So thank you so much, Kedara, for being with us today. I so enjoyed interviewing you and hearing about the work that you're doing. We just really appreciate your time and your efforts on the ground.
It was my pleasure, Kira. Thank you so much for spending time listening to me. We look forward to being in touch in future also. And my warm regards to all your team. And I hope that this interview reaches out to as many people as possible and many people know about the work that we do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So for more information on the Corbett Foundation, you can go to www.corbettfoundation.org. That's Corbett Foundation.org. And their handle is @theCorbettFoundation. So I have a quote for you today, as I like to do. This is a quote by Lester Brown, and it says, "One way or another, the choice will be made by our generation, but it will affect life on Earth for all generations to come." Make sure to rate our podcast if you haven't yet. We love those 5-star reviews, and they really do help us get the word out there and make the podcast that you're listening to a success. If you haven't had a chance to check out my other podcast, I'm going to just drop that in here right now. I host another podcast. I co-host it with a business partner of mine, Dina Thayer. We're both parent coaches, and we host a podcast called Raising Adults, Future-Focused Parenting. So if you like the sound of my dulcet tones, you can go ahead and check that out. Our show is produced by Eric Johnson, Kira Dorian, and Edge. Join us next week. Thanks for listening.